Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They weren't on the list. They strolled in anyway to a White House state dinner with the President of the United States and his full line of succession in attendance, not to mention the Prime Minister of India. They smiled and hugged Joe Biden, sashayed for the cameras. But it was a shocking security breach still reverberating this hour. On Point, White House security, the Salahi saga. And who's protecting the President? You can join the conversation. What if they hadn't been grinning socialites? Should heads roll here? Do you worry for the security of the President of the United States? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Yesterday, the House Homeland Security Committee held hearings on the White House security breach. Committee Chairman and Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson of Mississippi described the breach as extremely serious and potentially dangerous.
We're not concerned about agency embarrassment, discomfort, or shame cannot serve as a substitute for performance. The security gaps at issue cannot be explained away as missteps by a few frontline employees. There were undeniable planning and execution failures of the entire Secret Service apparatus, with security failings that seemed to hang over that evening like a fog. We are all fortunate that this diplomatic celebration did not become a night of horror.
Night of horror, the words of Benny Thompson, the chair there. Secret Service Director Mark Sullivan took responsibility for allowing the Salahis into the White House.
Preliminary findings have determined that established procedures related to entering the White House were not followed at an initial checkpoint. In error in judgment, a mistake was made. In our line of work, we cannot afford even one mistake.
A mistake was made. Joining me now from Washington is Roxanne Roberts. She's a style writer for the Washington Post, co-author of the Post's Reliable Source column. She was at the state dinner for Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and pointed the party crashers out to White House staff. Roxanne Roberts, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Well, you've been in the spotlight in the week and some days since
this
night.
A little bit, yes.
Holy smokes. And, you know, you look at the pictures, it all looks just kind of fun. On the other hand, here are the Salahis, you know, with their hand on the chest of the vice president and chit-chatting with the president of the United States. Is this going to sort of just riffle away in the breeze, or is there something bigger going on here, something bigger at stake, Roxanne?
Well, I think that the White House and Washington has an opportunity to examine this and make changes. In many ways, everybody was very lucky. Usually when system failures are determined, it's because somebody got hurt or died. And this didn't happen in this instance. But it revealed some very serious flaws in the security surrounding the president, surrounding the White House. And it's now a chance for everybody to look at that. The one mitigating factor may be that the Democrats and the White House are not thrilled to keep this story out front. And I know that they would like to put all the blame on the Secret Service. I don't know if that's really fair. But I don't think the story is going to go away.
Let's hear the voices of these two who got all dressed up and made quite a stir that night, appearing on the Today Show. This was Tuesday. Tarek and Michaela Salahi. They praised the Secret Service and said they were cooperating with them in their investigation into what went wrong.
Well, you know, Matt, one of the things that that we're doing is we're working closely with the Secret Service in their internal investigation and
respect everything they do.
We're respecting their timeline and we're working on their timeline. And we want to get through that process. We've been very candid with them. We've turned over documentation to them, and we'll continue to work with the U.S. Secret Service completely all the way through this process.
Sounding very reasonable, very serious, but then they're kind of trying out to be on what, Real Housewives of Washington, D.C., is it, Roxanne?
If this couple told me the sky was blue, I would get another source before I put it in the paper.
And you know, it
can... they are not the most truthful people. I would say that yes, what this was all about was to enhance their profile for the show called Real Housewives of D.C. There have been other branches of this in Atlanta and Orange County and New York. And right now, Bravo is in the process of following around some what I would sort of say second-tier socialites. And I mean that from the standpoint that real political insiders, real wives of powerful figures in Washington would not participate in this show. It's just not the kind of thing that would happen. And so all the people around and involved in this show are people who are sort of on the fringes of Washington society. And that was what alerted me in the first place. When they walked in, and I've said this before, I was totally shocked. I didn't think they had crashed, but I could not imagine how they had somehow managed to get a ticket for the first state dinner of the Obama administration. State dinner invitations are probably one of the best invitations you can ever get. Mm. And the fact that they waltzed in was a shock to me.
And think about India here and Indians. I mean, I can remember back in the early 90s, Rajiv Gandhi, was blown up by a woman greeting him in a public ceremony. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen here. Take us through the TikTok. How did this actually happen? We're going to get to the bigger issues of presidential security. But on this night, at this place, at this state dinner, how did it happen?
Well, this is what we know happened prior to them walking in. She told a number of people, including this production company, that they had been invited to the state dinner. We know from emails that they were desperately trying to get an invitation and were exchanging emails of a mutual friend who worked in the Pentagon asking if they could get, quote, tickets. It indicates a certain naivete because you don't get tickets to go to a state dinner. You get an engraved invitation.
But this friend, Michelle Jones, is the White House liaison for the Pentagon.
So
it's not as though she wouldn't potentially somehow be connected.
She was connected, but she wasn't in a position to get them into a state dinner.
But she didn't say that straight up, as far as I can tell.
No, she didn't, did she? And that's part of the reason the couple is claiming that they, quote, thought they were invited.
Mm-hmm.
So cameras were following her all day. For 7 hours, she was at a Georgetown salon talking about how excited she was to get invited and what a great honor it was. One of the stylists asked to see the invitation. She said, I think I left it in the car.
These are the Real Housewives.
Should have been a
TV
red flag.
Cameras. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And then they get all dressed up, and a camera crew accompanies them to the gate, where the first line of security, in fact, worked. Their vehicle. When you get invited to a state dinner, if you legitimately get invited, mm-hmm. you are asked to supply, when you RSVP, yes, your Social Security number, your birth date, and if you're arriving by car, the make, the model, mm-hmm. the name of the driver, all his information. And that's for background checks, for criminal checks. So obviously they had not done that, and their car was originally turned away. They hop out of the car, camera crew in tow, and come to the first gate where, according to their version, and this we can't confirm, one Secret Service agent just allowed them to go through. The cameras at that point were no longer with them. Then they were somehow able to, and this is the murky part, walk their way up through with the other guests. They said that they proffered their passport as ID, but their names were never on any list as far as we've been determined so far.
Mm-hmm.
And so then once they were passed, then they went through magnetometers to prove that they didn't have any weapons. Every guest has to do that. And then they were in. There's no longer any checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
So they then go down a long hallway. At the end of that hallway, a Marine announces their names, Mr. and Mrs. Salahi. And they start to walk through the area. And the only place where the press is at that point in terms of the guests is behind ropes in the area where you see them walking past.
Right.
And there are cameras and print reporters. I am there because I've covered many, many, many state dinners. And my head jerked up because I looked up and I thought, could that possibly be? You know, you have one of those
cut.
Moments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that they made the cut. And I thought, does the White House know they're involved with this you know, reality TV show? And how on earth did they pull this? Because I knew they're not wealthy. They are not high up in any political circles. And I wasn't aware of any connection to the country of India. So then I immediately looked at the list. And the White House releases a list to the press of all the invited guests. And I looked at the list and they weren't on it, which is also really weird. And I turned to a White House staffer within – I checked the timestamp on the picture that our photographer took, and it was 7:35. I would say by 7:36, one White House staffer knew, because I said, can you please verify the identity of that couple that just came through, the one in the red dress? I
said, I believe it's – And was this Desiree Rogers you turned to at that point?
No. No, Desiree, I'll get to her in a moment.
Yeah.
This was a staffer who was in charge of handling the press, and I said – their names aren't on the list. That's kind of weird. Can you please verify their identity and tell me why they're not on the list? And I said the same thing to another staffer, again, in charge of the press, before we were escorted back to the press room. And the only reason I think that's significant is that it shows that even though security at the door had failed, the White House was aware of the fact. Two people were aware of the fact before they went through the receiving line that there was at least a question about why they were there. And but this is a relatively – it was their first state dinner. The staff is relatively inexperienced in doing that. Desiree, the social secretary, was a guest at the dinner. She was not patrolling things.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the saga of the White House party crashers, the U.S. Secret Service, and who is protecting the president. Roxanne Roberts is with us from the Washington Post. It has the reliable source column in the paper. She was there. Ronald Kessler joins us in just a moment. At yesterday's House Homeland Security Committee hearing, Secret Service Director Mark Sullivan, again here, took some tough questions from Congress. Here's Texas Republican Michael McCaul.
How in the world could this couple get past the Secret Service without having their names on the list and get right up to the President of the United States?
Sir, I've asked myself that question 1,000 times over the last week.
1,000 times, and it's still being asked. Let's get a call right here. Arlene in Manchester, Connecticut. You're on the air, Arlene.
Yes, hi. Actually, my observation goes beyond the Salahis. I'm concerned about the overall security, because do you remember this summer when people would come to appearances of the president openly toting guns and claiming they had every right to do so? Frankly, when I lived in Washington, I used to go to church with the Clintons, and we had to go through metal detectors just to get inside our own church, even if we were well known by the people there. They were incredibly careful. So I do not understand this overall approach to security.
We're going to pick that up right here. We'll pick it up, Arlene. Thank you for your call. Ronald Kessler joins us from Washington. He is author of In the President's Secret Service, Behind the Scenes with Agents in the Line of Fire and the Presidents They Protect. He's argued that the security breach at the White House is symptomatic of larger problems in the Secret Service. He was at the Homeland Security Committee hearing on the security breach yesterday. Ron Kessler, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You hear Arlene's concern. She went to church with the Clintons in the 90s and said, you know, even church members couldn't get in there. Now you've got people waltzing straight into the White House in a state dinner.
You know, her particular concern, I don't think, is a problem. Gun-toting demonstrators, idiots though they are, were kept far away from the actual event. And if they tried to get any closer, they would have been arrested. So, but the larger problem is that the Secret Service has been totally derelict in its duty to protect the president, basically since Homeland Security took it over in 2003. That's when they started cutting corners. And
what do you mean by cutting corners, Ron?
Well,
what do you mean by derelict? Those are pretty big charges.
There's this series of examples, and you know, if the president is assassinated and there's another Warren Commission, they'll go back to these shortcomings. For example, the Secret Service on a regular basis does not do magnetometer or metal detection screening at major events. For example, when Joe Biden threw the first pitch at the Orioles game last April.
In Baltimore.
Secret Service did absolutely no screening of anybody. It was just like letting passengers into an airplane without putting them through metal detectors.
With how many people in the stadium, and did they know he was going to be there?
They did. It was announced a day beforehand. There were about 50 stories. AP had the story that he was going to be there. There were about 40,000 spectators, but that's very common for the Secret Service to screen that number of people. And, you know, what is more important than protecting the life of the president and the vice president? They also will shut down magnetometer screening early under pressure from candidates, staffs, or from the White House, including the Bush White House. The staff will say, you know, everyone's out there. The event's about to start. Just let them in, let them in. And they'll let them in. And this goes back to bowing to pressure, which I think was part of the issue here at the White House. When Mary Cheney was under protection,
This is the vice president's daughter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. She would insist that agents take her friends to restaurants. Well, they're not taxi drivers. We're not paying high-paid law enforcement officers to take her friends to restaurants. And the Secret Service rightly objected. And because of that, she got her detail leader removed. In other words, management of Secret Service took her side and remove someone for doing his job. So that is, in my opinion, one of the things that went through the mind of this Secret Service uniformed officer who let the couple in at the White House.
You mean they're not on the list, but maybe somebody important wants them in, so we don't know, so in they go, we might get in trouble.
Exactly. As well as his knowledge of the corner cutting. In other words, you know, if the Secret Service doesn't care about such things as magnetometer screening and a number of other things that they have been cutting back on, for example, they've cut back on the size of counter-assault teams. They're not even allowing agents time for regular firearms requalification or physical training, and then they cover that up by asking agents to fill out their own test scores. I mean, it would be unthinkable in the FBI, which I've also done books on, for that to happen. So secondly, he had that in mind. Third, I think the uniform division and the agents are totally overwhelmed. They're totally underfunded, totally undermanned. They're forced to work 7 days a week, 12-hour days, even longer. So morale is very bad. They're overwhelmed. The one thing that Mark Sullivan, the Secret Service director, admitted to in the hearing that was germane to this larger institutional problem is he said at the guard post there was only one magnetometer, whereas normally there would be two. In other words, that, you know, would have contributed to a big crush of people. And
it was raining and people wanted to get in out of the rain. But still, it's the president. It's the president. Roxanne, I want to come to you.
There's one other point that has drawn a lot of attention, that typically at the door, at the gate, along with the agents, there is a member of the Social Secretary's staff. And that's important for the following reasons. While the Secret Service is absolutely in charge of the physical safety and check of each guest, the social office are the ones who live and breathe the guest list. They know it by the time a state dinner happens, which is months in the planning. They know these names. They sleep and dream these names. They can't get away from them. So the failure of the social office to man somebody so that if there was a question about whether somebody's name had inadvertently been left off the list, the social office person, if they didn't know the answer, they could have contacted somebody inside the White House. There was a decision made right before the dinner that there was no need for somebody from the social office to be there. And we don't know whether or not the White House pressured them to say, oh, come on, you guys handle it. We don't know the circumstances of that meeting yet. But we do know that the failure to have someone there is significant enough that the White House has already retrenched on that and said from now on there will be someone from the office there.
We know that Desiree Rogers, the social secretary of the White House, was attending the party, not the gate. And of course, this whole issue came up yesterday. Here's Republican Peter King of New York questioning Mark Sullivan, the Secret Service director, on the role of the White House social office in the security breach.
If somebody from the Social Secretary's office were standing where they've always stood in the past, the Salahis would not have gotten in.
It would have helped.
It would have helped. It would have helped, says Mark Sullivan there. And here's Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania, a congressman, saying it was unfair to pin full responsibility on the Secret Service.
You know, we always expect the Secret Service to take a bullet for the president. We don't expect the Secret Service to take a bullet for the president's staff.
Good point. Let's take a call. Bill, Nashville, Tennessee. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Go ahead.
What do you think, sir?
you know, I think that there's really a difference between an actual danger to the president and a social embarrassment, and I think that your program and a lot of the other coverage out there has conflated the two. The fact that people got close to the president and took pictures with the president is really unremarkable. People do that every day. They had no weapons on them, and that wasn't an accident. They went through proper screening. And, you know, I really think that people are inventing a pretext of a security issue so that they can talk about a tabloid socialized story. And, you know, I think that the story's gone on long enough. This isn't a week-long story. This is maybe a one-day story. You know, it just seems a little bit ridiculous. What's the big deal of taking a picture with the president? What are they going to do, punch him in the jaw? He's surrounded by Secret Service.
Bill, we'll pick that straight up. I mean, fair enough. On the other hand, there have been significant security concerns around this president long before he was president. And, you know, how much do you want to play around with the security of the president of the United States? But we'll pick it up. Let me get one more right here. John, in Hilton Head, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, Tom. I'm a pilot, and if I fly over or near the inside that zone of the White House, I lose my license. It's astronomical that you could even get in to see the president.
You can't even fly over it, and they could walk right in. John, thanks for that. And one more, Charlotte, North Carolina. Johnny, you're on the air, Johnny.
Well, my opinion of it, you don't get in there unless somebody wants you in there. And the thing about it was they said there wasn't nobody there from the White House staff. Now, don't that sound a little funny to you?
It does. It's a state dinner. You would absolutely assume there'd be somebody from the social office at the gate. We'll pick that one up as well. And one more, Scott in Burlington, Vermont. Thank you, Johnny. Scott, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I travel a lot, and, you know, my first inclination when I heard about the story was, again, like that caller you just had, it might be blown way out of proportion. This might be a one-day story. But you hear about they went to the magnetometers, and your first inclination is, okay, well, that's cool. At least they were gone through the right screening. You know, do these people have to remove their shoes? I mean, we have the Richard Reeds of the world out there. Are they allowed to bring liquids that could possibly be a liquid explosive into the White House? I mean, what level of screening, you know, are these folks really subjected to? Or is it equal to air travel with the TSA? Or you know, what is really being done on that front?
We'll pick it up as well. Okay, we've got a lot there. Ronald Kessler, first to you. Our first caller says this is blown out of proportion. This is a social embarrassment, not an actual danger. Let's all settle down here. You've paid a lot of attention. Do you buy that, Ron?
That is what the Secret Service has been saying, and it's just ridiculous because it so happens that today it was a blonde, tomorrow it could be an assassin. And even though they went through magnetometers, they could have brought in chemical weapons, biological weapons. They could have taken a knife off a table and stabbed the president in the heart as they were shaking hands with him. And Secret Service could do absolutely nothing about it. That's why you have security. And to say that, you know, gee, it was fine because it turned out these people were harmless is extremely short-sighted. The reason that Abraham Lincoln and JFK were both assassinated is they ignored advice about their security. And Barack Obama has issued a statement saying, you know, he's confident in the Secret Service. And I think that's really, really dangerous because an assassination, according to agents I've talked to, is a real possibility given all the corner cutting by the Secret Service.
Corner cutting, we still got to look at that. Let's get one from Pocatello, Idaho. Lynn, you're on the air, Lynn.
Hi. This is just an observation, but it seems incredibly naive to me to think that a metal detector is, I mean, that a gun or something metal that somebody's going to carry in is going to protect this president. There are all kinds of ways from, I hate to sound naive, but poison to a knife that's on a table. I mean, there are all kinds of ways to endanger this president and vice president. And it seems ridiculous that claiming that because they didn't have a gun or a knife on them is protection for this president.
That a metal detector, just not enough.
That's why they do the background check to see if these people are serial killers or are terrorists or agents of Iran or North Korea. That's the whole idea. And it is, as Roxanne said, the responsibility of the Secret Service to protect the president and the grounds. And it's true that having Social Secretary's office out there facilitates things, and they do check you off in a list initially. But the Secret Service uniformed officer who let them in could have just as easily made a phone call to the social secretary's office or used a walkie-talkie to ask if, in fact, they should be on the list. So in the end, it does come back to the Secret Service. And, you know, it's the Republicans who are trying to shift blame to the social secretary's office. But by law, it's the Secret Service that is solely responsible for security at the White House.
Roxanne,
to make one other point, mm-hmm. which is that one of the dilemmas here is trying to balance security and what I consider sort of politics. Most of the guests were VIPs. There was only one magnetometer. They were standing in line. As far as I know, nobody takes their shoes off as a guest. There is almost this assumption, which is one of the reasons the Salahis got away with this, that all the people there are important people and somehow safe people.
But isn't that why the list makes so much difference? If you're not on it, you could hypothetically be anybody.
Exactly, which is what, you know, what's shocking about this really has little to do with the Salahis as people. They're self-promoters, their reality show. But the fact that any two people, because if you try to track back and look at other assassinations, other tragedies, you would not have anticipated it in advance. There's a lot about it that you learn from the fact that it happened. This is an opportunity to learn from it when no one got hurt. And that's why I think it's really important to say, well, maybe we can't be so polite. Maybe people will have to take their shoes off. A lot of people, interestingly enough, brought cameras in. People said, well, how did they get all those pictures? Well, they had their own camera and took pictures and had other people take pictures of them. But lots of other guests had cameras. And the Secret Service made them put the camera on to show it was a working camera. But again, you know, if you're very clever and your intent is very evil, you can work your way around that pretty easily.
Here's a heated exchange. This was between the White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs and a reporter, April Ryan. She's with American Urban Radio Networks. And Ryan was asking Gibbs whether White House Social Secretary Desiree Rogers was neglecting her duties by attending the state dinner as a guest rather than paying attention here.
I'm being serious.
I'm giving you a serious answer. Was she at the dinner? Yes. She's the social secretary. She had the primary secretary. She had the primary secretary for running the dinner. I'm going to get back to weightier topics like 98,000 men and women in Afghanistan.
Weightier topics, to be sure. But what about, is there an attitude problem here, Roxanne Roberts, in the White House staff that you know, at the party, not at the gate, not paying attention right at the perimeter where security matters most?
Well, I will tell you this, is that in the last probably at least 20 years, the social secretary has always been, sort of think of it like a wedding planner, somebody whose job it is to make sure that every single detail runs exactly as it's supposed to, that if there is any last-minute screw-up, it's always been she's. Mm-hmm. She's there to take care of it and handle it. Now, I think it probably was not the best choice for Desiree to seat herself at the dinner and be a guest at the dinner, because that meant that a lot of those last-minute judgment calls had to be made by junior staffers.
But is that typical? Is that precedent?
No. I mean, in the last 20 years, I don't know of any social secretary who sat down at a state dinner. Certainly not the first. Occasionally the very last one when they had been in office for a very long time and everybody knew the drill. But remember, this was the Clinton's first. Obama's first. Mm-hmm. And they had a larger number. Usually the guest lists are smaller, but they decided to put it on a tent on the South Lawn. So they had over 300 people coming in here. And so I think it's fair to at least ask questions of, Desiree, what were you doing?
I guess so. And I'm sure, people will try to ask them. So far, she's not coming to the hearings, and the White House is saying, you know, she's privileged and may not. Roxanne Roberts with The Washington Post, who was there and spoke up right away. Thank you very much for being with us today, Roxanne.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the saga of the White House party crashers, the Secret Service, and who's protecting the President of the United States these days. Ronald Kessler is with us. He's the author of In the President's Secret Service. He joins us from Washington, D.C. In an interview yesterday with USA Today and the Detroit Free Press, President Obama was asked about his confidence in the Secret Service following the security breach.
the system didn't work the way it was supposed to.
Right.
Having said that, I could not have more confidence in the Secret Service. They do an outstanding job. They have been with me since I was a candidate. I trust them 100%, not just with me, but with my wife and my children.
Ron Kessler, the president says he trusts them 100%. Is he wrong in that?
Well, the agents themselves are very brave and dedicated, and they'll take a bullet for the president. And so I can see why Obama would feel that way because of his contact with the agents. And by the way, he's very respectful of agents. He's invited them to dinner along with Michelle, as opposed to some other previous presidents who were just the opposite, such as Jimmy Carter. He would tell them he didn't even want them to say hello to him in the morning. But he I think that he is ignoring, and he's certainly aware of what's in my book, in the President's Secret Service, the larger picture of the institutional breakdown of the Secret Service. And it, besides the corner cutting I mentioned, it relates to underfunding. The total budget is $1.4 billion, which is a joke when you consider how many people they have to protect.
Sounds like a lot.
Well, it's half the price of a stealth bomber. Besides the president and the vice president, they protect about 30 other individuals, including Michelle Obama's mother. They also are responsible for security at national nominating conventions, for visiting heads of state, for the Pope, and the G20 summit, as well as doing investigations into counterfeiting, et cetera.
Why does bringing them under Homeland Security create a problem? You say that it does, but why should that be the case?
Well, it's part of the problem because at that point they started having to compete for budgets with 21 other national security agencies. And somehow the just being in that agency started this corner cutting. It's sort of hard to pin down how a government scandal starts, and I do call it a scandal. It's just like the SEC ignoring the Madoff tips. You can't understand why they do it, but they do it. But it's also a cultural problem within the management. At the hearing yesterday, Mark Sullivan said this was a human error, and that was it. There was no institutional breakdown. But there was a culture of, we make do with less. We had it hard, so we're going to make it harder for you. When I interviewed Mark Sullivan for this book, he said, you know, soldiers in Iraq have it much harder than agents do. They have to sleep on the floor. They're being shot
every day.
That's
really not the point, is it?
That's not the point. These agents are not 22-year-olds. They are very experienced professional security experts, and they could get two or three or four times their salary in the private sector. So here's, you know, the head of this agency saying, you know, we really don't care. You got to have it hard. That's not the way you foster good morale or keep agents. The attrition rate has been increasing dramatically. In fact, within the uniform division, which was most responsible for this breach, it's 12% a year turnover. That is incredible. And so they bring in less experienced people. They have people who are not as well qualified. So all these things come together, I think, to create this fiasco at the White House.
Now, there's an impression, which you have helped create, that President Obama has faced a lot more threats than other presidents. You've written that there has been a 400% increase in threats against this president over previous presidents. At the hearings, Mark Sullivan, Secret Service head, said it is not 400%. He's not sure where that number came from and has been saying it's actually kind of a normal threat level, which isn't small, maybe 3,000 a year under George W. Bush, but he's saying it's normal, Ron Kessler.
Yeah, he said at the hearing at this particular time it's normal. But on March 25th, he testified publicly on the Hill that threats against the president are at high levels, quote. So he has acknowledged publicly that threats were up substantially in the past, but they do, of course, fluctuate. And so I take him at, you know, I believe he's telling the truth now, but certainly in the past, it has been at astronomical levels.
And certainly the committee chairman, Benny Thompson, has no small concern about this president. David in Hanover, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I've been listening to your show. It's a fabulous show, but nobody's mentioned the fact that you had the Prime Minister of India there.
Oh, that's actually not true, David. We mentioned that right from the very top and several times,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
But the transparency of the Obama administration of basically trying to be honest and, you know, let the general public know everything in advance, I think that sometimes maybe you should be a little bit more hush-hush, because I think the prime minister probably has a lot more enemies than President Obama, and it could have been a perfect setup for somebody to, especially Pakistanis or terrorists from the Far East, to have taken and tried to do an assassination of the prime minister, not our own president.
Yeah, you know, David, let us pick it up. I mean, yes, we very much said the Indian prime minister was there. India has a bitter experience of public assassinations. But I mean, you can hardly keep a state dinner hush hush. But Ron Kessler, Dave is quite right that, you know, it's not just the President of the United States with potential enemies. You know, India, we saw the terrorism in Mumbai last year. They're right there in the region of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and with their own internal situations. I mean, this was a loaded situation at the White House.
Well, you know, we do have a system where it is announced beforehand that the president or other dignitaries are going to be at a certain location. But that's exactly why you need good security, why you need to go through magnetometers, have background checks in the case of the White House. When I interviewed Nicholas Trotta, the head of security of protection at the Secret Service, for the book in the President's Secret Service, he began the conversation by saying, you know, now we put everyone through magnetometers, whereas when Ronald Reagan was shot, we didn't. And that's why Hinckley was able to get off those shots. And I said to him, well, what about the times when you don't? And what about the times when you shut it down early? And then he admitted that that was true, but he defended it. He defended it on the record. He said, well, at a stadium, for example, we can let people in to a higher level without doing a metal detection. Well, you can just picture how quickly 20 terrorists who could have been let in with firearms, with grenades, could run down from a higher level of a stadium and take out the president. That's how George W. Bush almost was assassinated in the country of Georgia when the local authorities decided to shut down magnetometers. A guy brought in a grenade, threw it at the president. It landed near him, but luckily it did not go off. So that's why, you know, behind all this is this underfunding and the idea within the Secret Service, oh, we make do with less, we don't need any more money. They should double or triple the number of agents and magnetometers so they can do everybody in a stadium and they don't have to cut corners like that.
Let's get a call from Putnam Station in New York. Joe, you're on the air, Joe.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for getting to this call.
Yeah.
First of all, I think the Secret Service do an excellent job. Those people are really dedicated. And the responsibility has to be accepted, even maybe more so, by the White House social staff.
Mm-hmm.
And people who want to harm the president, this is very serious, I think, because people who want to harm the president now know it's very possible to get close to him, even under a heavy security situation. I worry now about some copycat attempts.
Could somebody else try the same thing the Salahis did and slip in? I mean, clearly it shows something's possible that I imagine most people would have imagined as impossible. The White House so far has not wanted to put the social staff on the Hill. Here's a little tape from yesterday at the hearing again. Republican Congressman Peter King of New York saying he was dismayed that the White House Social Secretary Desiree Rogers wouldn't appear before the committee.
This was a bipartisan request, Mr. Chairman, a bipartisan request to the White House, which prides itself on being open, which prides itself on cooperation. But in this instance, they are stonewalling.
Now, that's a little rich from Republicans who, you know, cited White House privilege again and again during the George W. Bush administration. But Ronald Kessler, you hear our caller Joe's concern that, you know, you could get copycats.
Oh, absolutely. And not only at the White House, but at other events. This will definitely tip off terrorists that, gee, you know, maybe security isn't as good as we thought. And, you know, maybe we can use more sophisticated methods than the Salahis used to get in or to get off a shot at the president. You know, to begin with, even with the best security, it's almost a miracle that we don't have more assassinations, because if you have a president who wants to go out there and schmooze, you know, there's always the possibility of a more sophisticated attack. But if you don't do the most basic security, which you might have at a high-profile party in Hollywood, and you just let people in, then you're absolutely asking for an assassination. And that is the last thing our country needs. And we have to think in terms of what would actually happen if there was an assassination. What would how would we go back and remedy it? And the answer is we need a new Secret Service director who is not dismissive of the threats. We need a budget that is two or three times higher than it is now. You know, when you think of the stimulus package of almost $800 billion and then compare that with $1.4 billion for the Secret Service every year.
Yeah, no
one, and it's actually been going down when inflation is taken into account. That is a serious problem.
Mosamy in Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Mosamy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was born and raised in India, and I still shudder at the memory of the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi. And this incident of the White House just made me realize again that if it's so easy to get to the president, the people in the public, like the general people like me, are such an easy target for the terrorists in public places.
Yeah, Rajiv Gandhi, it was, as I recall, this is back in 91 in Chennai, a woman bowing to him with dynamite wrapped under her sari. And, you know, there was, in a flash, the poor man was dead. I was in India after Indira Gandhi's assassination. I remember sitting with Rajiv Gandhi, thinking just how vulnerable anyone is in this world. But quite right, it could easily, for Indians, certainly most of you, bring that one to mind. And thank you for your call. Al in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Al, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There's something fundamental that I haven't heard anybody allude to today.
Mm-hmm.
The agent at the gate was told what guests had to have in order to go through. These guests didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
It's apparent that he didn't call anybody and he just let them go through. Now that's so basic, and when I tie you put that next to Mr. Sullivan's testimony that he took full responsibility, and when asked how it could happen, he said, "I've asked myself that 1,000 times."
Mm-hmm.
You have a quintessential example of incompetence. And the idea that this could be the organization that's protecting the president amazes me. I'm kind of amazed that nobody gets to that fundamental situation.
Well, certainly that agent at the gate should have felt the full authority to say no. And we've heard from Ronald Kessler and a bit maybe from Roxanne why he may not have. But that's a pretty odd dynamic, not what we expect. Thank you, Al. Eric in Norfolk, Virginia. Eric, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I really personally believe the Salehis should be charged with felony federal trespassing. They were not invited. They conspired. They put on their clothes. They went to an affair. They were totally uninvited.
Brought TV cameras to the gate with them.
I can't believe it. No one's mentioned anything about what they've done.
So
that's my issue.
Right. What about it, Ron Kessler? The law and the Salehis, are they vulnerable to prosecution here or not?
Oh, I think there's no question they will be prosecuted under the law that the gentleman mentioned. Possibly also under lying to a federal agent. There has got to be a deterrent here to future behavior along that line. And to the caller in Wellesley, near my hometown of Belmont, Mass., he mentioned a very good point, which is that Director Sullivan in the hearing described it all to human error. Well, human error is not a situation where you consciously make a decision to ignore the fact that someone is on a guest list. That is not human error. That is a conscious decision to engage in malfeasance. And that's why you have to look at these broader issues that are behind what he did. And it ranges from, you know, the poor morale, being overwhelmed, being aware of corner cutting, being aware of pressure, not wanting to make waves. Mm. And there's another point, which is that the Secret Service engages in deceit. And that, of course, is always bad when you look at any employee's performance. For example, when members of Congress go to the Secret Service training facility in Beltsville, Maryland, actually Laurel, but they call it Beltsville, which I also went to for this book.
Mm.
The Secret Service will put on this performance of presenting scenarios where threats appear and the agents take it out, suppress it, et cetera. But the scenarios are presented as being spontaneous. In fact, when it comes to these visits by members of Congress, the Secret Service rehearses beforehand, so they know exactly what the threat is, who it's going to be, what it's going to consist of. In addition, the Secret Service pads its arrest statistics on counterfeiting and other financial crimes. They take credit for arrest by local police. That's something that the FBI used to do under J. Edgar Hoover. They seem to think that that's somehow going to, you know, impress Congress. Meanwhile, it wastes time, wastes agents' time, and it creates a deceitful culture. And the agents themselves, as I said, are very brave and dedicated. And the FBI, I know, admires Secret Service agents more than any other law enforcement. And I've been very impressed as well in meeting them. But when you have this culture within the management of deceit and corner cutting, and you know, we don't we make do with less and lack of consideration, then it all comes together to this breakdown that we saw at the White House.
Well, it's all in the spotlight now, off of this couple dressed up for a night out in a tent on the White House lawn. Here's a comment from our website from Rich. He says, "I'm just so relieved that the intruders were two clowns. As much as I dislike them, I'm glad they brought up this weakness of security. God forbid, what if it was someone more sinister crashing with a nefarious intent?" Ronald Kessler, author of In the President's Secret Service. Thank you very much, Ron, for being with us this hour. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, Marika Spence, and John Wibby, with help from Suzanne Merkelson and Patrick Rosso. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.